History Nerds and Historians. My name is Christina.
And I'm Jody.
And I'm Shay.
And this is Effed Up History. This is where we talk about a little bit of history that's super fucked up. So today I have Jody and Shay with me from the Rainy Day Rabbit Holes podcast. Is there anything that you all would like to kind of take a moment to tell us about your podcast a little bit more than I had put in, like, when I briefly mentioned in my Medusa episode about a month ago? If so, go ahead and take the stage.
Our podcast is somewhat similar and also dissimilar to yours in that we talk about stories from history as well. And we do love effed up stories as well. But mostly we just like to say that we F up history. In that we don't.
I would never say that though.
But we will. We don't mind calling ourselves morons.
Right. We've already boosted you once before and talked about your effed up history program, and that we just F up history.
I like hard yelled at Shay when I was talking to her on the phone about that. I was like, don't you dare disservice yourself. You guys are beautiful and wonderful and smart and amazing. How dare you disservice yourself and say that you do that? I mean, it was like a 20 minute rant where I was just so like, funny. Girl, shut the fuck up, wash your face and sit down.
And this is how women support women. I love it.
No, we are not experts at anything. And we just really love history, and we really love the Pacific Northwest. We like to deliver our stories with a little bit of humor and silliness and just make it fun to learn. And that's what we love about this, is just we're having a good time learning, and we want other people to have a good time learning as well.
Yep. Just sparking interest in the area and all of our history.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I love that. That's kind of why I started mine too. So for my listeners, hello, nice to see you again. So Shay and Jody and I wanted to get together and collab on this podcast because we felt that we have this like really interesting intersection between our specialties, even though they say that there are not specialties in everything. They literally have a podcast about the Pacific Northwest, which is a specialty. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm going to gas them up because when you talk down about yourself, I just don't like it.
All right, I'll let you spank me for that.
We have this like intersection kind of the history of the satanic panics and how things that people fear the most have kind of changed over time. So of course my kind of subject area is the early modern witch hunts, which is, I would argue, kind of like the original satanic panic.
Absolutely.
But honestly, I also just like have an interest in societal beliefs surrounding the devil in general, because like historically we all know, like if you read anything about the witch trials, if you read anything about beliefs in the devil and stuff like that from the 1400s and the 1500s to 1600s, whatever, you know what the monarchy believes, you know what the clergy believes, you know, like what the leading historians and demonologists believe, but there's not a lot of emphasis of what the common people believe and like the everyday Joe who's like a farmer or a general merchant or anything like that. And that's really interesting to me, especially in places like England and the British American colonies, because the witchcraft accusations were not made by the people at the top during these times. It was made by the people at the bottom. And so I kind of want to like talk a little bit about that as well. But that, like, after the 1700s, that's where my expertise ends, and I have very little knowledge outside of that. So that's where Jody and Shay are gonna come in, especially because like Shay was telling me that there's like weirdly a lot of satanic panic related incidences in the Pacific Northwest. Yeah, that, yeah, I'm absolutely super excited to learn more about, because the way that you describe it sounds like, have we changed that much?
That's what I was gonna 400 say years? Is there is a through line in through the witch trials to the satanic panic of the 1980s through to today, right, which there is a, right, through line, and there's so many similarities. And I like to say that there's no new ideas. They're just recycled.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've just been 100%. Recycled
history
and repurposed.
Repeats itself and exactly. repeats itself and repeats itself and repeats itself. So that is what we're going to be exploring today. So we're going to have the first part over on this podcast where we're kind of talking about what I specialize in. And then the second part is going to be on their podcast. So make sure you go and check out both to get the whole story and timeline. And without further ado, sit back, relax, and practice your, oh good God, what the fuck faces. Before we begin, I do want to give a brief trigger warning. We'll be talking about a slew of different topics, so this might not be all encompassing for everything that we will discuss, but I know for sure that I will be discussing things like kidnapping, sexual assault, torture, death, murder, maybe suicide. There will be a lot of talk about religion and demons and the devil, some talk about the Bible and different translations over time. This isn't like an anti-religion talk. It's more like a anti how religion has been weaponized over time, especially in regards to like witch panics and satanic panics and overall transitions of beliefs. This is a historical talk about witch panics. This is not a religious talk about witch panics. This isn't a religious talk about the evolution of Satan. This is a historic and sarcastic at times all over the place kind of thing. So that might not be all encompassing of everything that we're going to discuss, but viewer discretion is advised for sensitive materials incoming. All right, well, let's get started. So I guess the good thing to begin sort of talking about with the devil and Lucifer and Satan's satanic panics would be just to like talk about Satan. I do want to say like I am not religious at all. So this is not at all going to be a religious conversation about Satan. This is going to be a historical conversation about Satan. And I'm not sure how you, Shane, Jody, how you feel about that. But that's how it's going to be. Sort of on my end.
So in my part, there is going to be a little bit of talk about religion and politics, because that the satanic panic did have an effect on some policies in the United States. So there is a tie-in. So we do have to talk about it a little bit. And I'm never going to say that you can't believe what you want to believe. But anyways, we'll get to that.
That's kind of how I feel too. Like, and I don't want to say for any of my listeners who, or any of Shay and Jody's listeners, I'm not anti-religious. I'm just not religious. So if you believe in things, that's totally fine. It's just, this is not like a theologian talking about the theory of the devil. This is like a mediocre historian talking about the history of the devil and mythology and all of that.
Mediocre? Didn't we just talk about, I think you're an excellent historian.
I think we're on the same page when it comes to religion. We feel about the same.
Okay. Good. I didn't realize that Lucifer was actually a mythological figure from Greek and Roman mythology. That's something that I've learned pretty recently. So in Greek mythology, there is a very minor character named Phosphorus. And by minor, I mean like, in the Greek Myths by Robert Graves, which is like my holy grail that I always go to when I look at Greek mythology, it is like literally an 800-page compendium of pretty much every Greek myth that you can think of. He is mentioned once as this guy named Phosphorus.
Is it Phosphorus like the element, or Phosphorus with a TH?
Phosphorus like the element.
Wow. Oh, okay.
So his name is Phosphorus. He is the son of Eos, who is the goddess of dawn. So when he is mentioned by name, only that one time in that myth, it's basically that Eos, goddess of dawn, was fucking Ares, the god of war.
That's my god, because I'm an Ares.
Oh no.
Oh no, that's
she's
not
Gemini.
My god.
She's the god of war.
I can't really say anything. I'm a Gemini, so that comes with its own negativities every day.
I'm an Aquarius. There's no problems.
We're perfect. You're just like, I'm just going with the flow. Yeah. We're going with the flow. We're just not talking about anything. So Aries had like a really long-standing relationship with Aphrodite, goddess of love. Aphrodite was not married to Aries, but had like many, many children by him and was very possessive of him. And when she caught Eos and Aries in bed together, she cursed Eos to just have this like constant longing for mortals, that she would just see an attractive dude and become so overcome with lust that she would just like kidnap men and do things, which is interesting to see a woman do this, because this is commonly something that Zeus does, commonly something that other male gods do as well. Eos is now doing this. And one of those people that she does this to is this guy named Cephalus, although sometimes he's referred to as Astraeus, depending on the myth that you're kind of looking at. And he was a mortal son of Hermes, the messenger god. So Eos becomes obsessed with Cephalus. She kidnaps him, brings him to Syria, and rapes him. And one of the children that she has as a result of this kidnapping is Phosphorus, the morning star.
I was going to say, it's nice to see the gender roles reversed, maybe.
It's always conflicting when I have this. It's like, it's nice to see a woman at the top, but also, like, could we not have the rape?
Yeah, could we just stop with the sexual assault?
Right. Can we just, everyone is being raped. Could we just stop that, please? Yes. I don't like it. So this is, again, like the only time that he's mentioned by name. The only other time that we really see the morning star mentioned in Robert Graves is when they're talking about a different figure that is said to be fathered by the morning star, or it'll talk about how like, oh, the morning star like brings in the dawn, right? So what does this have to do with devil and Lucifer? Well, Roman mythology, which a lot of the time is like the same and very similar to Greek mythology. Oftentimes it's the same, but the names are just changed. So in this case, in this myth, Eos becomes Aurora, Aphrodite becomes Venus, Aries becomes Mars, Hermes becomes Mercury, and Phosphorus becomes Lucifer. So Lucifer appears right before sunrise. He brings in the day. He's sometimes depicted in Roman mythology how Cupid is often depicted in art as this like small little cherub, baby child's winged, cute little scary thing, right? Sometimes he's depicted as a wingman with a torch, but he is not at all a major god in the Roman pantheon. And every time he's mentioned in Ovid, it's basically saying that he just like drove off the stars, that he summons his mother, Aurora, which I think is funny. And Jody, like you could probably relate to it, because like I just picture my kid like coming in and waking me up every morning. And that's kind of how it sounds like what Lucifer does to Aurora every morning is like coming and waking her up and being like, good morning, mommy. It's time to start the day. Let's go.
It's done. They're all bright and cheery.
It's
and
you're done. Like, let's go.
So he didn't start out as some sort of representation of evil. He just, it almost sounds like he was positive. He's bringing in the dawn.
Yeah, he was the herald of the morning is what he was told. And there's like nothing negative with him at all in Greek and Roman mythology. There's nothing really. I mean, again, and even in Ovid, who's like, I love Ovid so much. But when he mentions it, he's just like, oh, yeah, he brings in the day. Or there are some times where like, oh, just like how the morning star is the brightest star in the sky, this person is the most beautiful or the strongest. Like he's used as a comparison. Like there's nothing really like interesting with that.
And he's not terrifying or punishing or leading you down a wrong track.
No, he's just the one who brings in the morning. He's a very minor figure.
Did they ever describe what he looked like? Was he a beautiful god character?
Yeah, no, he's either depicted as like a tiny little cherub, sort of more like a child with wings, or he's depicted as a beautiful man carrying a torch.
Oh,
and
okay.
That's it. The interesting thing is that like the morning star is actually Venus, so the planet Venus. So it's always interesting to kind of look at the myth and how that like connects, and they didn't even realize how it connects. But No, he's not anything negative at all. The only thing that's negative about him in this myth is that Cephalus, I'm choosing to pronounce Cephalus, his father, but on Google and on YouTube it says Cephalus, and then he gives like he's father to a guy named Sakes. So like the only thing negative about Lucifer in the Roman myths is that like his father sounds like syphilis but is not syphilis, and his son sounds like sex but is not sex, and that is just like bad for me needing to pronounce every syllable and changing the way that it's pronounced, and that's pretty much like the only negative.
So syphilis in medical terminology is your head. So does that
translate,
and it comes from Greek and Latin. Medical terms usually are Greek or Latin in origination. Does that have anything to do with the description of Cephalus?
Not that I can think of. I mean, he's not mentioned very much, and from what I've read, if he is, he's a very minor character. He's like god. He's a son of Hermes / Mercury, and then like an Athenian princess, and he's just really beautiful and is kidnapped. So I don't think so, but maybe he has another myth, or maybe there's another character that's also named Cephalus that that has a bigger role, but not in this myth.
In any least. Physical descriptions, literally... does he have a body or is he just a head?
You're trying to link it to the head.
Wondering how he got there.
His head was very beautiful, which is why he was kidnapped. But no, I mean, I have no idea outside of that. So then to kind of like move into Hebrew beliefs after a while, in the Hebrew beliefs, he is still the son of the morning. Like he's still the morning star. In the original Hebrew beliefs, his name is Hillel ben Shahar, but when it's translated into English, they call him Lucifer. And the interesting thing is that instead of him taking on like, oh, he's the herald of the morning, he's the one that awakens Aurora, he's the one who brings in the day, his story changes and it turns it into like, he is prideful. He's no longer the star that heralds in the morning. He is stubborn. He is rebellious. He is that prideful star that like refuses to wink out and has to be the last one in the sky. He is the one that is defying sunrise. He is the one who is being basically just the fucking worst. And that is like this new story that becomes associated with him, but he's still the son of the morning, which I thought was very interesting. And then Lucifer becomes an angel, the chief archangel for God. And he's also described as a cherub, just like how he's described as a cherub as the son of morning in Roman mythology. On the third day of creation, when God is all done creating land, the story is that Lucifer is walking in Eden and he is just like decked out in jewels. Specifically, it says carnelian, topaz, emerald, diamond, beryl, onyx, jasper, sapphire, and carbuncle, all set in gold. So this man is just like bedazzled with all of the jewels. And he's just walking through Eden being like, man, this place is amazing. And God's like, if you think this place is amazing, you can be guardian of all of the nations. And Lucifer, again with that like prideful, rebellious, brightest star who refuses to wink out kind of energy, is brought into this story of him as an archangel, and we start to see that pride with him as he's walking around in his bedazzled robes, and he decides that he is not going to be guardian of all nations. He's too good for that. He is going to ascend above the clouds and become equal to God. But because God is all-knowing, he immediately figures this out and casts him from Eden to Earth and from Earth to Sheol, which is not hell. It's more like a Greek underworld where the dead go, but it's not like the Christian depiction of hell. And as Lucifer falls from Eden into Sheol, he is shining bright like lightning. And now he just like flutters in darkness in this like pit of despair. So that's like the original Hebrew part of it. Yeah.
Now I'm wondering if this is the origin of the biblical phrase that you hear a lot, the pride goeth before a fall.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
It's been a long time since I've read the Bible, so I don't I don't remember where exactly that comes from. I'm sure there's biblical historians out there that can set me right, but I mean, that sounds like a good origin of
it. I'll probably get an email sure. being like, actually.
I also find it very interesting that, you know, God was just creating the world and Lucifer already knew what natural materials were fabulous.
We're just fabulous. He's got all the rainbow on him. Just
I know.
Like, this is he just likes shiny things.
He's like a crow.
He's a crow. He's a little magpie. He just needs all the shiny things on him at all times.
Exactly. Oh,
that's great.
So then, like, as far as the Torah, the Jewish Torah that then becomes like the Old Testament of the Bible, Hillel ben Shahar / Lucifer is only mentioned by name once. So it's, again, very similar to like the Greek and Roman myths that he's only mentioned once by name in the Bible as Lucifer. I literally like downloaded the ebook on my Kindle and just like searched Lucifer. And he only comes up once. And it is in the book of Isaiah, where it's Isaiah 14:12. And he's basically talking to the king of Babylon. And he's telling the king of Babylon that he will fall. And he likens him to Lucifer. And it's basically like the same thing of like, if you were to tell me like something really poetic, and I'd be like, okay, Shakespeare, look at you. Like, it's basically the same kind of energy in the Bible of Isaiah being like, okay, Lucifer, yeah, sure, you're gonna ascend above the heavens, and then you will fall just like Lucifer did. But Isaiah doesn't even like emphasize much on the story and downfall and punishment of Lucifer, because it's believed to just have been so commonly known by everybody that he didn't need to say anything. And interestingly enough, like, Satan is not mentioned until the 13th book of the Bible. Huh. And devil in the Old Testament never occurs as a singular. It only occurs as a plural, talking more about demons. In the New Testament, obviously, it's a singular because everything changes in the New Testament. But in the Old Testament, those original ones, it's never the devil singular. It is the devil's plural. And the snake in the Garden of Eden is never described as a snake or as the devil. It's described as a serpent. Hmm. And that's it. But we have later interpretations that we put back onto it that make it into becoming the serpent is the devil.
So a king of, or a lord of the underworld was not really referenced. It was more of just there's some bad demons out there, and there was not a specific like big baddie.
That's what I've pulled from it. Now, I think that Satan is mentioned by name in later books of the Bible, but originally in those first few books where it's talking about like the downfall of man and you know, the creation of the world and all of these things, like he's not mentioned in the Bible, at least. It's more what comes before that. At least that's what I've pulled from it, and that's at least what I understand, although I'm sure that someone will probably correct
right.
me at some point and set me correct. It's been a long time since I've read the Bible. I took a class in college that looked at the Bible as a piece of literature, which was a very interesting class to take, with a lot of people who did not look at the Bible as a piece of literature.
Interesting, yeah.
But it was definitely different.
Well, and different translations of the Bible are going to 100%. Result in some different interpretations of these stories based upon the interpreter's biases. So I can definitely see the story changing just through those translations.
For sure. Let me see if I can pull it up. I have like a whole thing where, because there's a lot of discourse of like the discussion of, let me see if I can pull it up. The discussion of the term witch in the Bible and all of the parts of it that have to do with
the thou shalt not suffer a witch to live part.
Yeah, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. Leviticus 20, was it 2027? No, that's not 2027. It is 2020. Oh my gosh, what is it? Exodus 22:18, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. So I went through, because I was really curious about like how the Bible has changed over time and how those words kind of factor into it. Because something that we'll kind of talk about, you have King James, who was like the witch hunter king. He becomes king in 1603 in England. He was originally the king of Scotland, and he was heavily involved in witch trials. And he is the same King James of the King James version of the Bible. And a lot of people have said that because he is that person who's associated with the King James version of the Bible, and because he is the person who hunted witches so much, that he is the one who changed it to "thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." And before that, it was like a poisoner of wells or whatever.
Wow.
So I went through and I kind of looked to see what I could find. And the Tyndale Bible, I think it's called, which came out in like the 1520s, which predated the King James Version by like almost 100 years, also says "thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." And the Vulgate, which is the Catholic Latin version, says "thou shalt not suffer a wizard to live," which does change like the gender of the witch, but still maleficos is what it says, which is the term for like witches and evildoers. But the interesting thing is that kind of connects to like the serpent in the Bible is the Vulgate. I was looking up recently. I do not speak Latin, so I'm not even gonna like try to really pronounce it properly.
It's a special skill.
It talks about, yeah, no, it's not one that I have. it talks about pythonic spirits is what it calls. Like, so in the King James Version of the Bible, it says like basically like don't consult any witches, don't use divination, don't ask any questions about them for an enchanter, a witch, a charmer, a consulter with a familiar spirit, a wizard, or a necromancer is what's in the King James Version of the Bible. But all of these are called pythonic spirits in the Vulgate. And so I'm kind of like looking into the background of the word python versus serpent. Serpens is what it calls it. And see like kind of what goes into that, because my like main focus as a historian of witchcraft is the witch's familiar, which is taking on animal forms. So it's just kind of like a really interesting thing when you look at all the different translations. And to talk, to go of like what you were talking about, the whole like translation of the Bible, the Bible is an ever-changing translation document that is constantly changing. For like, do you know about the whole like adding of homosexuality into the Bible in the 20th century?
No, I don't. I mean, the only thing I can think of that I remember from my biblical past is the whole Sodom and Gomorrah section, which is where we supposedly get the sodomy. But that's kind of the extent of my knowledge of homosexuality in the Bible.
I did take a college course. I went to a Lutheran college, so I had to take two religion courses, and one of them was literature, the Book of John. So I don't recall talking about homosexuality in that, but we did discuss a lot about how the Bible has changed over the years, how it originated, who wrote these books, where the information came from, and how it's changed.
Yeah, there's a whole like documentary series that I can't remember the name of off the top of my head, but there's this whole documentary series because like the term homosexual wasn't added into the Bible until like the mid 1940s. And so before that, like phrases that were said to have meant to be homosexual or were said to like mean homosexuality could have also been interpreted in other ways. So it's interesting that like homosexual, the argument behind it is that it was basically a piece of propaganda to like justify the hatred of homosexuality that Christianity's having, the opposition to homosexuality that a lot of Christians were having during that time period. And they translated the Bible with intention to say, oh, well, the Bible is against homosexuality, so we also have to be against homosexuality as well, when that's not technically what the Bible was saying, except for the verse where it's like, man shall not lie with man as he does with woman or something like that. So yeah, the Bible is just like an ever-changing interpretation. There's also the whole idea of like, yeah, it's completely a tool. And it's also based on the people who are translating it. Yes, so like, the fruit of, the Bible that Eve eats, that, you know, the serpent convinces Eve to eat and then she feeds it to Adam and they're like dispelled from Eden, was never specified to be an apple until it was translated into Latin, because like evil in Latin is very similar to the word apple in Latin. So before that, it was just like the fruit, you know, or the fruit of the tree of knowledge or whatever. And then when it was translated into Latin, they were like, oh, maleficium or like malefic mm-hmm. is evil. And then like malum is apple. Isn't that so interesting? It must have been an apple, where like apples don't grow in Mesopotamia.
Right. That's what I was wondering.
So, yeah, I've seen it referred to as a pomegranate as well. That was a little bit more of an accurate fruit. Though it's metaphor. The literal fruit does not matter.
Yes, correct.
It doesn't. But if you tell some people that it wasn't an apple,
they get their knickers in a bunch.
Well, I think when you tell people it's metaphor, that they get their knickers in a bunch.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and if you were to tell people that they are basing their beliefs, their strongly held beliefs, on a series of stories that have been changed over the preceding centuries based upon the translator's own biases, they're not going to believe you. If they're like taking it literally word for word, well, you're literally word for word is not literally what it says.
Well, I mean, if we want to go literally word for word, we got to go back to the original Greek. Right. And I bet like everyone needs to learn Greek now and learn it that way. And that was the only acceptable way, because anything after that is, you know,
the translations are not literal. So it's really hard to one for one.
Right. And then if you also are to take it in the vein of looking at how it incorporates the preceding religions and mythos into the Christian mythos, then you have to think a little bit deeper about this. Anyway, I digress. Tangents.
No, I love it. I it's a very interesting topic to talk about, like, basically, I'm gonna say evolution, but like the evolution of the Bible and how it changes over time is just a very interesting thing to kind of look at and analyze.
And throughout the world, it's different. I once had a medical resident from England, and he was talking to me about, he was warned coming over to America that people take the Bible literally. They read it literally. And he's like, mm-hmm. Nobody would do that. And I was like, not only do they take it literally, you better shut your mouth. Don't say that too loud.
Don't say that here. Especially where I'm from in the South.
Yes, exactly. He was just stunned that we would actually take it word for word and literally rather than the...
I mean, I'm originally from Florida, which I think I don't even have to elaborate anymore.
No,
for you to know how people are down there.
Yes.
How are people up in Pacific Northwest when it comes to that? Do you have a lot of that, or is it more liberal? Or
it's depends on where you're at. I mean, Western Washington, Eastern Washington are literally two different states when it comes to that. Mm-hmm. Very liberal in the Western Washington, Seattle side, and opposite over on the other side.
Yeah, we have the bigger urban areas over here in Western Washington, you know, around Seattle and Tacoma and Olympia. And then Eastern Washington is a lot more rural. And so there tends to be a little bit more of, it's definitely red on the eastern part of the state and a little bit bluer on the western part of the state. But mostly just because we have the population density around the urban areas. Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. It's so weird when I moved up, because I live in Salem, Massachusetts now, and it's weird to come up here from Florida. I've been living here for almost 3 years, and like, there are rainbows on the churches. All the churches have rainbow flags and Black Lives Matter flags and all that kind of stuff. And that was bananas to me to see coming from Florida, where you're not going to see like any of that down there.
So openly, proudly displaying those flags. Yeah, interesting.
The difference of beliefs within, in your case, just within one state, you know, versus completely different parts of the country is just, it's astounding to me. But back on topic, I guess.
We digress.
I don't know. I love going on tangents. I go on tangents by myself when I'm talking by myself on my podcast. I make myself go into my own tangents. So it's nice to actually like talk to someone else with a tangent.
Yeah, we do.
That makes a little bit more sense. It makes a little bit more sense when you have someone else with you than you're going on tangents rather than just me letting my ADHD shine completely.
Definitely adds interesting content. That's for sure.
That's one word for it, I guess. So to kind of like move out of that into the more medieval period, which is where you really see like witch trials starting to take off. Eventually the story of the devil and Satan changes again. There are some people, some like Catholic monks who would say that Lucifer was the product or the byproduct, I guess, of an unholy union between a nun and a demon, which doesn't necessarily make sense based on the beliefs of the Bible and everything that we've talked about. But that is what some people were saying, mainly because during the medieval period, it wasn't witches that were really like people were afraid of. It was succubi and incubi. And more so incubi. Incubi would outnumber succubi 10 to 1. So for anyone who doesn't know that might be listening, an incubi is basically like a sexual demon, right? It's believed during the medieval period to be an angel whose carnal lusts led to its downfall. An incubus is like the male version of it, and a succubus is the female version of it. And because of misogyny and patriarchal societies that have been around in perpetuity in a lot of areas, you're gonna more so see an incubi because they're targeting women more than a succubi is targeting men. The interesting thing is is that like there were some demons who were said to be able to transition between a male form and a female form, which also led to other fears, and especially incubus and succubi targeting churches and targeting monasteries, and sleeping with monks and nuns and impregnating them.
Trans demon.
Yeah, trans demons, but it could go back and forth. So they're like gender fluid demons. You know, they could one day, mm-hmm. they would like be a female succubus, sleep with a man, and then they would like hold on to that sperm, change themselves into a male incubus, and then sleep with a woman, and then impregnate that woman with the semen from the man that they slept with as a succubus.
So this was a way to bypass the actual sex that happened between two people. Nope, it wasn't us. It was demons.
Nuns and monks are not having sex.
No, of course not.
Obviously.
Yes.
They were not doing that. Yes. This is how it happened. It was incubi and succubi that were just going around and just collecting semen samples and artificially inseminating nuns. And that's how they got pregnant, okay?
It's a great way to cleanse yourself of any wrongdoing.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. When you can blame it on a demon, which is, we'll get to that in the whole like Lucifer and Satan panic thing. It's a great way to not take Fantastic. Any responsibility for your own actions.
Well, yeah. And you also couldn't have a bunch of nuns claiming to be Virgin Marys again, because then we would have a ton of Jesuses too. And like, you can't have just a ton of Jesuses.
Right.
So we have the one Virgin Mary. And then when all these other nuns get pregnant, it's the work of the devil, clearly. Like, it's not them doing anything.
Sorry, hold on. If you have sex with an incubus and you were a virgin, are you still a virgin? Does the incubus break yes. your hymen? I mean, that's what I want to know.
That's a good question, because they did actually fuck.
So supernatural like, dick doesn't count.
No,
against your virginity.
It doesn't. Not to the nuns. Or if it did, it would be just like a strike against you, but you could still be a nun, at least for as far as I've kind of pulled from it.
Because it wasn't
also
fault.
These things were like heavily swept under the rug, right? The funniest story that I saw, one of the weirdest stories, I guess, that I saw was this nun named Madeleine Bavant, I think is how you would pronounce her name, who was at a monastery. She apparently enters her cell at the monastery where she sees... So like an incubus wasn't always just like a humanoid form. It could disguise itself in a lot of different ways. Sometimes it would be like... a satyr, sometimes it would be like a goat, sometimes it would be another kind of animal, sometimes it would be humanoid, but for the most part it would disguise itself in different ways. And so the story with Madeleine Bavant is that she goes into her cell at the monastery and sees a cat sitting on her bed with a giant man-sized dick.
Convenient.
Just fully erect.
Convenient.
Fully erect just, and ready for her.
My brain tried to make that image and then like shut down.
It's like a
please
a sex toy.
I want you to listen and just close your eyes and imagine right. what I'm saying. So there's a cat, a normal cat sitting on her bed with a giant man-sized fully erect dick. Okay. And she sees it and she's like, oh, that's not something that I want to see. And she runs away. And the cat with the giant man-sized erect dick chases her down, drags her back into bed, ravishes her, and quote unquote makes her feel the most peculiar sensation. and that is what she would tell people. That is how that happened. Not any other way. That is what truly happened with her. Because sex with a, to kind of answer your question, I think that this kind of sex with an incubus or a succubus for a lot of people was looked at more like bestiality. So I think they would still be considered a virgin or whatever.
Okay. So it wasn't the physical act of having been penetrated. It was by another living
human.
Well, it has to be a human in order for it to be considered a
sex history is. Sex history is not completely something that I would consider myself incredibly well versed in, but I would think that because it would be more looked at as bestiality, it was still a sin, but not the same as sex.
Now, is it only a sin if you liked it?
That makes you feel a peculiar sensation.
Yes, peculiar sensation in your pantaloons.
As long as that doesn't arise, you're
good. In your rough nun underwear.
Well, you know, it's like, what is it, the Mormons, they believe in soaking.
Yes.
Which is where it's the friction. It's the friction that's the sin, not the penetration that's the sin. So if you know.
Or where just, they have like a friend move their bed for them, that's what creates the back and forth because you're not actually doing it yourself.
So and you're that's all clear. Okay.
It's not me. I'm all clear. It's not me. another fun fact about like the whole like gender switching that incubi and succubi could do is that there were also some people that believed that because they could switch genders, they could also fuck themselves. So they could make themselves have dual genitalia and just
I'm
have
trying,
sex with themselves.
I'm trying to figure out the mechanics yes. of that. And again, why would you need to go do it with
anybody your eyes
else?
And think really hard. I mean,
you'd never get
they were just their
then.
Own sex toy. I know. Right. They were their own sex toy. They didn't need anything else. I mean, sex toys, I mean, well, there's a long history of sex toys
sure.
too. But, you know, we didn't have vibrators back then. So, you know, I don't know. So to kind of like continue on into witchcraft. So this is like your beliefs leading up to like the major witch trials. Not to say that there weren't witch trials and not to say that there wasn't witchcraft before the medieval period, because there was. The Epic of Gilgamesh, which is like the first written document that we have evidence of, has a witch in it. Like, it's a big part of it. So witchcraft has existed time immemorial, right? Since Mesopotamia, we have evidence of it. Ancient Egypt, we have evidence of it. But it was very, very different to how it was during the medieval period into the time of the witch hunts. So there's this one historian named Richard Kiekeffer, I think is how you pronounce his name. And he says that there are four stages of medieval witchcraft, starting in the year 1300. So from 1300 to 1333, during this time is when the Pope was residing in France, in Avignon, I think is how you pronounce it, France. And there were rumors about witchcraft happening in the area. And everyone was kind of like, hey, dude, like, what are you gonna do about this? There's like witchcraft and sorcery happening. What are we gonna do about this? And in 1320, he kind of releases this papal bull in which he basically like declares war on witchcraft, makes it so that the inquisitorial process can start loosely. Like, you don't fully see it until a little bit later on, but like, you do have these priests who are very much like reaching, who are starting to accuse people of witchcraft. And the first one that you really see that becomes very popular is in Ireland. Her name was Alice Keidler. So for any of my listeners, or any of Jodi and Shay's listeners, I've already done an episode on Alice Keidler, so I won't go into like incredible detail with her, but she's like the quote unquote first witch of Ireland. I have an issue with calling her that. I actually did an entire presentation for a conference in where I said that like, she's not a witch at all, because although she's like accused of it, she's never convicted of witchcraft. She's not executed for witchcraft. But she's the first quote unquote witch of Ireland. I don't think she's a witch. I think that she was a black widow who would marry people and then kill them for their money. it's a very interesting episode. I recommend listening.
I'm going to go back and listen to that. I'll have to ask Newell's, because now 15% of our listeners are in Ireland because of Newell's on Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. So I'm going to have to reach out and see if she knows about this character. So that's really cool.
If you ever find yourself in Kilkenny, Ireland, you can go to the Keidler Inn, which is the inn that was owned by Alice Keidler, dating from the 1300s. It is like, and from my knowledge, the longest running inn in Ireland. You can go there, you can have an ale, you can get some food. And it belonged to the first quote unquote witch of Ireland. She was a business owner. She owned an inn. She was incredibly successful. She knew all of the gossip. She knew everybody. People were falling head over heels for her left and right. She was married 4 times, and all of her husbands died in mysterious ways that are very similar to symptoms of poisoning. Like, oh, I wonder what happened there. In my opinion, at least. Allegedly.
Or also, maybe she was just a woman who was doing stuff for herself and people didn't like that. So obviously she's a witch.
So that's what becomes the accusation. So like, after this Pope passes this papal bull that's like, yeah, go for it, witchcraft, sir, we're going against sorcery, go for it,
that's a Pope's memo for our listeners. Pope's memo. Yeah.
So a papal bull is like a formal statement by the Pope. So this Pope is like, go for it, attack, have at it with the witches, just because sorcery is happening, right? And so there is a priest over in Ireland who sees Alice Keidler as this like woman on her own, in charge. She's an HBIC. She's taking no shit from anybody. And he's like, you are a witch. And she's like, I am? Okay, sure.
Goddamn uppity women.
It becomes this whole drama where he's like, you're a witch. And she's like, actually, I'm not. And then he becomes like, he gets arrested. The Pope, like the priest, gets arrested. He gets thrown in jail. He comes in his full regalia and he accuses her again. And she denies it. But this time, like, they arrest her. She breaks out of prison. She flees to, we don't know, think maybe somewhere in England. She flees. So she's never... she's arrested for witchcraft, but she's never convicted. She's never executed for it or anything like that. She has a servant named Petronilla who is convicted of witchcraft and burned at the stake for witchcraft in Ireland. And in my opinion, she's the first witch of Ireland, but she doesn't have a sensational story. But it's not typically like, during this like time period, it's not typically like diabolical, devilish witchcraft. It's typically political. It's sorcery. It's consorting with demons, but it's not necessarily like, I am doing this as a servant of the devil. I am doing this like as a minion of the devil. It's more so like, I'm using my resources very well, which one of my resources just happens to be a demon named Robin. And, you know, this is what we do.
Robin? That's yeah, she demon. My demon's name is George.
That's the name of the ghost that lives in my house. I've named him George. But yeah, so Robin was actually like a really common name for demons and for fairies during this time period. For some reason, you see it over and over and over again. Robin, or the English version Robert, you see it a lot, and it's very, very interesting.
Sorry, are these demons what become the witch's familiar, basically?
So, kind of. The witch's familiar, which I can go into more detail later on if you want to, but the witch's familiar is kind of this like lower demon. It is a hybrid between like an animal and a demon. So Robin, in this Alice Kyler case, was described more like an incubus than a familiar, but he takes animal form. So I do think that there is some aspect of the familiar that comes from this belief in the incubus and the succubus.
Okay.
Because the familiar is this like really weird thing that just like pops up in England. And there are other little stories that you'll find throughout Europe, but they're not necessarily super negative. There's like the Lair's Familiar in the Netherlands, I think. There's the Victolin in Germany. And there are these like little animal demons that are kind of described similar to like how brownies are described, like fairies, brownies that will come and like be super helpful in your household and do things for you and whatever. And they're not wholly negative.
I want some brownies.
Right. Where are these brownies?
I know.
I mean, brownies and brownies.
I want a brownie.
All the brownies.
I will take both. I want a brownie to bake me brownies. That
yes.
Oh, God.
Perfect, yes.
So, you know, you kind of have these, like, there's this big argument of, like, what exactly how the familiar took form. And there are some people that think that it comes from fairy lore. I'm more so of someone who believes that it comes from, like, demon lore. So I do think that there is parts of where the incubus becomes later on through basically, like, a game of telephone, historical telephone, becomes something that leads to the familiar.
Okay, bear with me here with this train of thought I
have.
Go for it. Batman.
Batman.
His sidekick is named Robin. So
absolutely.
Is Robin just his familiar?
Okay. Totally, 100%. We just adopt orphan children and we turn them into our familiar.
Exactly.
Well, I was thinking about Robin Hood, which is not children, but goods. I don't know.
Robin Hood is an interesting one too, but no, for your Batman one, yeah, we adopt abandoned children and we make them into our familiars, and then we stand on building tops and stare out and talk about vengeance, and that's what we do.
We don't go to therapy. We work out our problems by beating up criminals. Okay, so move back.
I mean, we digress.
Let's go back to witches and devils.
Everyone needs therapy. So. True. So that was sort of like the first stage of medieval witchcraft that you see. That's where witch trials happened beforehand, obviously, but this is where they kind of start to become pretty serious. 1320 becomes kind of like a turning point for medieval witchcraft. The second stage that Richard Kaikefer talks about is from 1330 to 1375. This is actually a time period that's like incredibly mild. There's very little that's happening. These witch trial cases are not diabolical at all. 1375 to 1435 is the third stage of witchcraft in medieval Europe. This is where we start to see diabolical magic. This is where we start to see like the beginning of what you could call the satanic panic, the original satanic panic. Basically, during this time, there were debates about like the very definition of witchcraft and what it meant to be a witch. And there were all of these like theologians, these professors and faculty at University of Paris who were debating whether maleficium, which is just the fancy word of magic done to do harm, was idolatry, was it rejection of religious beliefs, or was it diabolical? Was it from the devil? And these theological professors and theologians came to the conclusion that it was diabolical. And that it was part of the devil's reign, pretty much. And the witch now becomes someone who is working for the devil, not someone who is utilizing the devil's power. And that is where it fully starts to become part of the inquisitorial process. That is where you start seeing people being tortured into confessions for witchcraft. You see a little bit of this diabolical magic with like the Alice Keidler case, but it's not full-fledged until this time period. Also during this time period, before this time period, if you were to accuse someone of being a witch and you were to be wrong, you would then be punished for it.
Oh, wow.
You would be someone who would be now susceptible to execution, susceptible to torture, anything like that.
Would they turn it back around on the accuser? As like, yeah, maybe they're the one who's actually practicing witchcraft if they're...
100%. Yeah, they would. They would be like, why are you accusing this person? Why are you lying? Why are you doing all, you know, the Bible says thou shalt not lie. Why are you lying? Why are you putting this accusation on this person that we can't prove? But in the late 1300s and the beginning of the 1400s, they kind of do away with this. So now you have people who are starting to be able to sort of like unabashedly make these accusations and not entirely be held accountable for it if they're wrong. So this is where you start seeing people getting like tortured for witchcraft. This is where you start seeing people be the inquisitors coming in and taking people for witchcraft. And then it really fully takes flight during the fourth period of medieval witchcraft, which is from 1435 to 1500. And this is the longest and the most important period. This is when we start getting books written about diabolical magic. This is when the Inquisition is really fully taking force. One of these books is called the Malleus Maleficarum. Malleus Maleficarum, a lot of times will be translated as the Hammer of Witches, but there are some translators who say that specifically Malleus Maleficarum should be translated as the Hammer of Sorceresses, meaning like female witches, which I think is a better definition because it's an entirely like terrible misogynistic text.
Witches was a more blanket non-gendered term for people who were practicing sorcery in the name of the devil.
Yeah, so prior to like this period, there was like sorcery was more so. I talk about it a little bit for any of my listeners. If you've listened to my last episode, this might be a repeat for you, but I'll say it again. It's a little like sorcery and witchcraft, according to a lot of like anthropologists and some historians, are different. So sorcery is something that you learn, something that you acquire, something that you seek out, whereas witchcraft is something that's more like inherent before this. So you have like sorcery being something that's really targeted, and a lot of the wording before this time period is against sorcery and magic, because sorcery is seeking out things that you shouldn't seek out, you know, it's the learning the dark arts that you shouldn't be learning. So it would be like sorcerer, sorceress. Witchcraft starts becoming sort of like the catch-all term after a while, though. But witch is gender neutral. You will sometimes have people who will say like wizard, witch and wizard. But for the most part, like you were accused and convicted of witchcraft. It wasn't like, oh, witchcraft and wizardry. Like this isn't like, it's not like Hogwarts where we've got like the witchcraft and wizardry. Like you're a witch and he's a wizard. It would just be like, you are a witch. Like in Salem, people would call some of the male victims wizards, but like it was witchcraft. Okay. And you were accused of witchcraft. So witch is a gender neutral term, but sorcerer and sorceress are different. So the Malleus Maleficarum was written in the 1480s during this like fourth stage of witchcraft. And it became one of the most influential texts in Western Europe. It was the second most sold book in Europe in the 1500s and 1600s, second to only the Bible.
Wow.
It was a book that was read by a lot of people because witchcraft became the satanic panic, you know, witchcraft became something that we are fearful of. Witchcraft became something that, like, we are really worried about. It was published in, like, 1486 or 1487, depending on the source that you read. I believe in 1484, there was another papal bull, you know, another declaration by the Pope. Pope's memo. Pope's official White House memo.
From the desk of the Pope. Sorry, I'm just looking at his
on
stationery.
special stamp stationery, exactly. That again declared basically a war on witchcraft and sorcery. So Malleus Maleficarum was written in the 1480s, late 1480s, by a man named Heinrich Kramer. Which is sometimes, like, his Latin name is Henry Institoris, and Jacob Sprenger, who they were both Dominican theologians and they were inquisitors. So they were people who were torturing people for witchcraft. They said that they had a lot of experience with it.
So this was like the Inquisitor's Bible.
It was the Witch Hunter's Guide.
Okay.
Yeah, so the Malleus Maleficarum has three different parts. The first part, I can read directly from my paper that I wrote. So part one offers quote unquote proof of sorcery in response to skepticism that people might have. It answers a series of questions covering three topics: the sorceress, the demon, and God's permission. Because a lot of arguments during this time were like, well, why does the devil even exist? Why do witches exist? If God is all-knowing and all-loving and all-powerful, why is he letting this happen? And so you have a lot of people who are doubting the power of God, who are doubting the power of free will, who are questioning a lot of these things. And these very, very devout Catholic monks are answering these skepticisms. And saying, like, this is exactly why. This is why he allows this to happen. He, with a capital H, allows this to happen. Part two are anecdotes of the quote-unquote actual practices of sorcery. And part three of the Malleus Maleficarum is the judicial side that discusses how to investigate, how to convict the sorceress, how to execute the sorceress, what things that you can say, what things that you can do. It is like your guide. It's based loosely off of another book that provides some of the same information, but Kramer and Sprenger took it and, like, ran with it. And it launched them into infamy, in my opinion.
So, question for you. So I am a normal, everyday person in 14.
Not normal.
In 1490, I bathe
it's
once
okay,
a
I'm
month.
Not normal
I've definitely
you bathe, like, not even once a month.
No, okay.
you're bathed on the day that you're born, and you're bathed on your wedding, and that's
okay. So I have a good stink going on about me, which definitely keeps evil spirits away.
Yeah,
and
you have your eating hand and your shit hand.
Yep,
you know,
exactly. Okay, think that maybe my neighbor Jody is a witch. What kind of things am I looking
Jody
for?
Catherine, no.
She is. She definitely is.
What kind of things am I looking for to prove that my neighbor Jody is a witch?
Yeah. So first and foremost, Kramer and Sprenger. Well, Kramer was probably the one who, like, fully wrote it, and then he added Springer's name to it. So Kramer would say, listen to the rumors in the town. Rumors, totally substantiated. Rumors, listen to those rumors, because most of them are probably true.
Well, people wouldn't say it if it wasn't true.
Right.
Oh, 100%.
Why would they make it up?
100%. So he would tell these witch hunters, go in and listen to what the people are saying. Because if they say that this woman's a witch, she probably is. If they say that this guy's a witch, he probably is, right? So you would look at things like, I mean, at least in England later on, you would look for things like crops failing, indescribable sickness, people dying, So maleficium, which is like the fancy term, is magic done to do harm. And by harm, it means magic done to do harm to a person, to their property, to their belongings, to their cattle, anything that will disrupt the home system. So someone dying, your cattle dying, your crops failing, your house burning down. If you have an argument with someone and then that person drops dead, people are going to whisper that, you know, you are a witch.
So Jody has a problem with me and my cow dies. So
yeah,
definitely she's a witch. All right. You're a witch, Jody.
I mean,
yeah, potentially.
I don't have a cow, but
it's not unusual for me to be called a witch.
You don't have a cow because Jody killed it.
Exactly. Like,
I mean, you would have had a cow if it wasn't for me.
You would. And this right now, this joking that we're doing could have led to someone actually being accused of witchcraft.
Oh, that's insane.
Damn it, I'm a witch.
My cow died. And you know what is really weird is that, like, you know, Shay, she got into an argument with Jody and then her cow dropped dead. And it's just really interesting to me because, like, they've been having feuds for a while. And it's just really interesting to me that, like, they ran into each other on the path and Jody's yelling at Shay. And then all of a sudden Shay's cow dies. I don't know. It's just weird if you ask me. Like, I don't know. And then that gets a game of telephone. And now all of a sudden you have a witch hunter coming in. And now someone's being dragged away to be tortured for witchcraft.
Wow.
It's like early McCarthyism.
It really is. And like, we'll talk about this when we talk about like the Salem witch trials. The Salem witch trials, the play The Crucible, which is what most people read that are when they're exposed to the Salem witch trials, is written by Arthur Miller as a response to McCarthyism. He's saying, like, oh, look at what's happening right now in the 1950s. It's exactly the same as the Salem witch trials. He's saying that McCarthyism is the Salem witch trials. And so he writes this play called The Crucible that says there are no witches. They are unsubstantiated. It's rumors spread and people being executed for it and arrested for it and all of these things and dying for it. And it's his commentary on McCarthyism. So it's a piece of fiction. And people come to Salem and they come to talk to me and be like, oh, well, you know, actually, Abigail Williams was fucking John Proctor. And I'm like, actually, Abigail Williams was 12. John Proctor was in his 60s.
I mean,
I doubt that was happening.
You hope. Well, but, I mean, when was that? I think that 12-year-olds got regularly fucked by 60-year-olds. Back in the day.
I mean, if you were to tell me that John Proctor fucked his servant, then I would say, like, yeah, possibly. Because he calls her, like, oh god, I don't remember exactly what he calls. John Proctor has a servant who becomes, like, one of the accusers at one point, and he, like, beats her and tells her that she's not actually accusing people, and he calls her, oh god, I have to look it up of what he calls her, but he calls her some silly name that some people have definitely interpreted to mean, like, that they were maybe fucking behind the scenes. But back in the medieval period, the torture that, like, the inquisitors would do was horrific. I've read some accounts. I won't tell them in incredible detail here because they are awful to hear about, but just to kind of, like, explain a little bit. It was physical torture that was justified on the grounds that since witchcraft was spiritual and not a physical thing, it was unlikely to be revealed through just a normal investigation. And the only way that you could get someone to actually confess was to put them under duress and force the confession out of them, is their mindset behind it. Death was not often very common, but they would say that, like, oh, if someone died while being tortured, it's the devil that did it, not the torturer. It's the devil that causes this person to die because the devil decided that he didn't want us to get the secret out of it.
Of course.
Or the other side of it would be like, oh, well, they're with God now. Aren't they so lucky that they died and they're with God? They would often have, like, physicians at wherever the torture was happening. So if they tortured someone too close to death, the physicians would heal them and then they would start torturing them again. Oh, I mean, it was an awful practice.
Bring them to the brink of death, bring them back, and then start over.
Yeah. And kind of the horrific thing of when you think of like society and the societal differences between class is that it wasn't uncommon for noblemen, bishops, kings, noble privileged women to attend torture sessions. They would go and watch people being tortured to death. For entertainment or to be a part of the process, to be able to say that they were there, to be able to tell people of the quote-unquote great things that people were doing in the name of God to extinguish these witches and agents of the devil. Churchmen and judges were always there. It was like a rule that they had to be there. And there were like different kinds of torture. I was reading a book that said that torture fell into two categories. So there's like the initial phase, which is preparatory torture, which didn't often leave physical marks on it. So this is from Lauren Payne. She's a historian who wrote a book called like Sex and Witchcraft, which she talks a lot about this. She goes a little extreme in some points, but she talks about how the victim in this first stage of preparatory torture, they're basically taken to watch people be tortured. And it's a psychological torture of saying, like, here you go. This is what you're about to be subjected to.
Wow.
Hoping that maybe they could get a confession before they had to do any real work.
Potentially.
Where would a confession get you, though? Were you still tortured?
It would get the torture to stop.
It would stop.
If you confess, you'd be executed.
Oh, okay.
But the torture would stop.
Okay. Got it.
So you don't have a way out of this. Yeah. You're doomed no matter what. No. There's no like, all right, well, say 20 Hail Marys and be on your way.
Pretty much. I mean, in the rare case that you would have been excused, you would be disabled for the rest of your life.
Sure.
In the most morbid and disgusting way, it's at times almost like a mercy that these people didn't make it longer afterwards, because the things that they would do to these people were horrific. And when you're put under duress, like, you're gonna say whatever you need to say to get it to stop. But they felt that, like, if you put this person under duress, like, they were at the point where, like, they wouldn't lie, they would say it, and these people were like totally fine. There were people who would say that, like you were saying, like, in like that preparatory torture where they would just watch in the hopes to get them to confess, that like you could promise as an inquisitor, like you could promise someone immunity and you can promise someone reduced punishment to get them to confess. But no, John Bodine, who was an awful guy, but he was a French theologian who would like torture children. So just to say like how great he was, said, quote, "A prisoner may be promised immunity or reduced punishment if he accuses accomplices, but no one is obliged to keep his word to a witch. Anyone sent to the torture chamber for the good of their soul must be tortured." And so they would think that like if this person was tortured into a confession, that would like absolve them of their sins potentially and they could go to heaven.
Oh, like for the suffering or they could cleaned them.
This torture is for you,
right?
Between this potentially, for your own good.
Potentially. The way that they would spin it to make themselves clean and pure, it's wild, wild to me at every sense of it. So you have a person that was doing these things who is now writing the book on how to hunt witches. So Heinrich Kramer, who was like the big guy who probably wrote it, he was born around 1430. He was a professor of theology. He was an inquisitor. He was heavily involved in the sale of indulgences, which was basically like the Catholics believe in purgatory and your loved one is suffering, but if you pay me more money, I'll say more prayers for your loved one and they'll get to heaven quicker. Oh, nice. And it was this like super controversial thing. Selling blessings, it was. And that's what led to the Protestant Reformation, largely.
Interesting. So this handbook came out in the late 1400s, right?
14.
And then...
Yeah, in the 1480s.
Did the... I'm trying to find my words here. Did this trend continue throughout up until the 1700s? Or did it die down in between and then come back again?
No, it got worse.
Okay.
In the 1500s was like the height of it all over. So Heinrich Kramer was German, and Germany had like the worst witch trials. I mean, it was kind of horrific. My main area of research is England, and England had like 1,000 witch trial cases. It was actually pretty small in comparison to the rest of places where like, I mean, Germany had tens of thousands of people who were accused of witchcraft.
Wow.
And a ton of people who were put on trial for it. Largely, arguably, reading this book, having this book on their desk while they were, like, accusing people and interrogating people.
So this witch hunt several centuries, this is really where... the devil as a character that is propagating evil throughout the world became set in the popular mindset.
Yeah. So the funny thing is that like before this time period in like the 1300s, the devil was kind of a joke. The devil was like someone that you can easily trick. He was someone who was like super dumb because God is all powerful and all knowing and the most intelligent being, right? The devil was dumb enough to defy him. He's an idiot. Like the devil, there would literally be stories of the devil being like, I'm going to get you, like chasing you through the forest. And people would like hide behind a tree and the devil would be like, oh, where'd they go? Oh man, swiper, no swiping. Like, oh man. And then would just like go on their way and would be like, you know, it would literally be jokes that people would tell.
Fooled the devil again.
Of being like, right, of just being like, the devil is so dumb. Like, oh, God, like, he's such an idiot. Oh. And people didn't like this, right? So I was talking about, like, the sale of indulgences. We can go into, like, the Protestant Reformation now. So in 1517, there was this guy in Germany named Martin Luther who didn't like the Catholic Church, who didn't like... Well, he loved the Catholic Church. He didn't like the way that the Catholic Church was practicing. Like, he loved Jesus. He loved being a priest and being a theologian. He did not like the way that the Catholic Church was doing things. He didn't like this depiction of the devil being this guy who's like, oh, super laughable. So on October 31st, 1517, Martin Luther, he writes down all of his things that he has wrong with the Roman Catholic Church. It is 95 reasons why that he has issues. It is only 4 less than Jay-Z. He has 95 problems with the Roman Catholic Church. And on October 31st, All Saints Day, or, you know, the All Saints Eve or whatever for him, nails these onto the door of the Roman Catholic Church and starts the Protestant Reformation in doing so. He's speaking out against the sale of indulgences. He's speaking out against a lot of things that the Pope is doing. This is also, like, I believe the, like, around the time period where you have, like, a Pope who, like, fathered children and was, like, very out about fathering children. I think that was the same time period. And so he's like, the church is completely corrupt. We need to go back to the beginning of the Bible. We need to go sola scriptura. We need to go by the Bible alone. There has been too much interpretation. There's been too much this. There's been too much that. Right. And then so to kind of like fast forward over the next, you know, 20 or 30 years or so, you have all of these other people who are like, you know what? By George, that man is right. Like, the Catholic Church does fucking suck. Like, we're gonna break away as well. But, like, we don't exactly believe what Martin Luther believes. We're gonna break off and do our own thing, right? So, now to kind of talk about England, which is where, like, my, you know, main research is on the witch trials there. You have King Henry VIII, who is just my favorite historical figure I've ever encountered. He's a great guy, no problems whatsoever. So King Henry VIII in the 1520s has been married to his wife for a while. She never has a son. He is obsessed with his lineage, and he decides that he wants to like break from the Roman Catholic Church and get a divorce, because he's asking the Pope for a divorce. And the Pope's like, dude, you've been married for like almost 20 years. I'm not going to annul your marriage. What the fuck are you talking about? And so he breaks from the Roman Catholic Church so that he can get a divorce. He makes himself the head of the church. It becomes the Church of England, the Anglican Church. And he gets his divorce, is married to her Anne Boleyn for very little bit of time, and then he beheads her. Then he gets married to another person and she dies. And he gets married to another person and he divorces her. And then he gets married to another person and he kills her. And then he gets married to another person and then he dies before he could, you know, torture her into whatever, right? Great guy. Love him. So this is the guy who actually passes the first Witchcraft Act in 1542 in England. So in 1542, you have this first Witchcraft Act that basically makes it illegal. So up until this point in England, any witchcraft accusations, any witch trials that happen is considered heresy. In Germany, it's considered heresy. Anything that's based off of the Malleus Maleficarum is considered heresy. It's considered a defiance against God, which means that you'll be burned at the stake. Because there was this whole idea that, like, you couldn't spill the blood of a heretic. So you couldn't behead them. You couldn't draw and quarter them. You couldn't do this. You couldn't do that. But you could just burn them alive, because that hypothetically doesn't
spill blood.
You know, any blood. Which is why people were burned at the stake for witchcraft. They were burned at the stake for heresy. King Henry VIII, when he passes this first Witchcraft Act in 1542... it no longer makes it heresy. It makes it against the law to be a witch. It makes it a crime that you can go to court for. So it's no longer going to be handled by the church. It's going to be handled by the courts, by the local courts. Mm. I don't know why he passes this. I can't find any historian that has talked about it. I can't find anything that was happening during this time period. I have been like trying to research it to see, like, was there some sort of event that triggered it? That made him want to pass this against witchcraft. Anne Boleyn, that second wife that he broke from the Catholic Church from, apparently right before he had her executed, he was like stomping around the castle being like, she was a witch. She bewitched me. It's all her fault that I broke from the Roman Catholic Church. She clearly was casting a spell on me. It's not my fault at all, right? In 1542, when he passes this Witchcraft Act, he's about to execute his fifth wife. And so I wonder if there's a part of it where he was like, well, if I accuse her of witchcraft, then I don't really need to have a lot of evidence against her. You know, that's just like me speculating. If he accused Anne Boleyn of witchcraft, was he trying to maybe plan of accusing Catherine Howard of witchcraft as well? Like, what was going on there? I'm not sure.
Well, it's a good way to speed up the process and get what you want.
Right.
You don't have to divorce them if you can just have the state execute them. And why would the king lie?
He didn't want to be divorced from his child bride. You know, she was 17 and he was 49. He didn't want to be divorced from his child bride. He wanted to just kill her because she dared to have sex with someone else before him, you know? passing a law that said that it was illegal to be a queen and have an affair. But you can be a king and have an affair. That's fine.
Well, of course.
Because we don't care about that. What it does is if you're a queen and you have an affair, then it calls into question any of your children. So that's illegal because we need to make sure that the bloodline is pure. But if you're a king and you have 70 children with all of your ladies in waiting and the mistresses, that's totally fine. You're a king. You're allowed to do whatever you want, right? So King Henry VIII passes this Witchcraft Act in England. No one's executed under it as far as I've found. When he dies and his son Edward takes over, his son is a very Protestant man. Like, he's a child. He's like 15. But he's very Protestant. And so he repeals the Witchcraft Act pretty immediately. Like, one of the first things he does is repeal the Witchcraft Act. And then he dies very quickly at a very young age. He's a teenager when he dies. And then there's this, like, basically almost a civil war that happens in England, because King Henry VIII had three kids. He had Mary, Elizabeth, and then Edward. And he takes Mary and Elizabeth. He calls them bastards. He does this, he does that. He just wants a son. But before he dies, he makes a line of succession in which he says, well, so my son Edward will be first in line, and then I'll be Mary, and then I'll be Elizabeth. And when King Edward becomes king, he changes the line of succession because Mary is a Catholic and they don't want Catholics to be in charge anymore. They want to be a Protestant country because they have issues with the Roman Catholic Church. And Mary is devoutly Catholic. So he ends up putting someone else on the throne. It's another teenage girl named Jane Grey. She becomes queen for 9 days. And Mary storms the city. She has a whole army behind her. And she takes the throne. She doesn't spill any blood at that point. But she becomes queen. She later on executes Jane because of like treason stuff. But it doesn't happen for like a year and a half until after she takes the throne. She is Catholic, meaning that she is taking Protestants, Protestant priests, people who are very big in the Church of England, and she is burning them at the stake for heresy. And she is very extreme in it. There's no witchcraft trials happening here, but there are people being burned at the stake for heresy. The name Bloody Mary is in reference to Queen Mary, because that was like a insulting name that Protestants were giving her because she was just killing so many Protestants for their beliefs. She ends up dying without any children. So Queen Elizabeth I, everyone knows Queen Bess, she becomes queen, and the Catholics are not happy that there's another Protestant on the throne. And so there are rumors pretty much immediately when she takes the throne that there are Catholics that are performing dark masses, that are summoning the devil and trying to kill her. And there's this whole discourse around this time between Protestants and Catholics where the Protestants are saying that the Catholics are devil worshipers. They're saying that Catholicism, that the devil wiggled his way into a Catholicism, and that's why it became so corrupt. And, you know, they're performing witchcraft every day. You're telling me I can say a couple words over this water and it now becomes magic water?
Oh, make sure. The rituals and magic, yeah.
Right. Like all the rituals that they're doing, the exorcisms, you're saying that you have control over demons? That's literally only God's dominion. Who are you as a priest to say that you can exorcise someone by the words that come out of your mouth? What are you talking about? Like, what are you doing that you think that you have this kind of control? You don't have any control at all. You're tricking us, and you are all demons. Like, they called the Pope the Antichrist. They were like super against Catholicism. And then the Catholics were saying that the Protestants were heretics and that heresy has always been associated with witchcraft. So like they're just like back and forth accusing everybody of being witches, pretty much. There's this discourse at the top between Catholics and Protestants, just going back and forth, calling each other witches and accusing them of all of these things. Because that's like the thing to do during this time period. The Protestants are no longer having this argument that the devil is someone that you can trick, that the devil is someone that you can just like laugh at and deceive. They're now saying like, no. The devil is incredibly smart. And the Protestants shift it from having this like the Catholics, you have to go through the church to have a relationship with God. You have to go to the church if you're beset by the devil. You have to go to the church if you feel yourself, you know, becoming susceptible to anything. Where the Protestants are like, oh, no, absolutely not. You can just pray. You don't have to go through the church if you don't want to. You have a direct line to God, and you can just pray straight to him, which now means that you also have a direct connection to the devil. And it is your personal responsibility to fight against him every single day of your life, because he is smart and he is tricky and he will do anything to deceive you. So this whole discourse between Catholicism and Protestantism leads to Queen Elizabeth passing a witchcraft act in 1563, that now again makes witchcraft something that you can be executed for in a court of law. When Elizabeth passes this Witchcraft Act in 1563, that's when you start to see the witch trials really happening in England. But like the satanic panic has already been underway. Arguably the first satanic panic of these witch trials has already been underway in Europe for like 100 years now, right? So you have the first person who's executed for witchcraft in 1566. There's about 1,000 people who are put on trial from 1566 through the early 1700s. About 500 of those people are executed for witchcraft. It's about 90% of those being women. So it is like a very like disproportional amount of men to women in all of Europe. But in England, it was about 90% women.
I didn't even know men were ever part of this at all. So,
yeah, there were men who were accused and there were men who were convicted. But a lot of times it was men who were like associated with the witch in some way. So a lot of times people believed that witchcraft was matrilineal. So you would inherit it from your mother. So if you were a son, but your mother was a witch, you could be accused or convicted of witchcraft. Or if you married a witch, someone who was accused of witchcraft, then you could be accused. Because like when you marry, you become one, right? At least in the Christian belief. So, you would have like those men, and then randomly you would have other men who were accused as well. Throughout the entirety of Europe, it was about 80% women to 20% men. In England, it was 90% women, like I've said. That's when you start to see the witches familiar, which I've gone into like extreme detail about on my podcast, so I won't go into like extreme detail about it here. But the witches familiar, like I kind of said earlier, it's like a half demon, half animal hybrid. And its goal is to help the witch in any way, shape, or form. It disguises itself as like pretty much anything that you see associated with witchcraft, you know, like a cat, a dog, a toad, a rat. But it could be like a butterfly. It could be a fly buzzing in your ear. Like it could be all of these different forms. And it starts to become that like you would sell your soul to the devil and in return you would be given a familiar who is supposed to help you. Who's supposed to do all of these different things for you. In the early witchcraft trials in England, the familiar almost becomes like a child to the person who's accused of witchcraft. They have to take care of it. They have to, you know, put it in a little basket. They treat it kind of like a child. They feed it from their body. They're given like a witch teat, like a witch mark somewhere on their body where they like nurse their familiar. They feed it a drop of their blood sometimes. They give it milk and bread and all these things. So in the early trials that you see from like the 1560s to the 1590s, it's a very motherly role that it takes. But after that, it starts to become more like an incubus and a succubus that we talked about before. So that's where I think like what you had asked, one of you had asked, I think it was Shay, about that's where like the familiar comes from.
Oh,
in
yeah,
the later
Robin.
Trials. Oh, yeah, yeah, with Robin and, like, is that where the familiar comes from? In the later trials, I think that they were looking back at those and kind of being like, oh, yeah, it's just like that, you know? So it starts to take on, like, a really sexual nature. The witch's mark in those early trials from 1560 to 1590 are like on your face, on your arm, on your leg, somewhere like that, where, like, the witch's teat in the 1600s is like in the small area of skin between your vagina and your anus, like, you know, places like that where
you're,
then it becomes
gooch?
Like yeah, in your gooch, on your taint, right? Of like that's where your familiar is gonna feed from, which then means like, okay, you're fucking your familiar.
Okay,
right?
I'm gonna be very sexual. Pause real quick to bring in some modern literature into this.
Go for it.
Have you read the book Good Omens by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett?
No, I've just bought it recently, but I haven't read
it. It's fantastic, and they did a fantastic series on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, it's got
with
David
Michael
Tennant
Sheen
in
and
it.
David Tennant. Yes. So one of the things is they have the Witchfinder Army, which is just one Scotsman. And his whole thing is counting nipples. And now I know why. Did you count their nipples?
Yeah. No, that's exactly it.
So, I love it. Also, she turned me into a newt.
That's from Monty Python, which exactly. is the best thing ever. Yes. The funny thing is that like Monty Python, that witch scene is hilarious, but it's actually like not accurate, but like the things that they were saying are incredibly smart, because when they like weigh her against a duck, it's because they would do something called swimming the witch, where they would like throw you into the water, and if you sank, then you were innocent, and if you floated, then you were a witch.
Right. They're doing that whole thing with throwing stuff in the water. What floats? Pieces of wood. Very small rocks.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
A duck. So if you're lighter than a duck, you're going to float, which means you're a witch, right? It's actually like a really brilliant scene with how hilarious it is. The Witchfinder in Good Omens is probably based off of the Witchfinder General.
Yep, that's what he calls he's the Witchfinder General.
Yep. Yeah, so that was a character. So that was a real person named Matthew Hopkins in the 1640s. During the Civil War in England, Matthew Hopkins took advantage of it. And Matthew Hopkins was like a complete misogynist. He hated everything. He hated women. He hated everything. And he would go into towns and be like, I'm the witch finder general. I'm here to find your witches. And it was in Essex County in England, mostly. And he would go to these towns with his group of lady prickers, is what they called them. Mm-hmm. And he would be like, I'm here to find your witches. And then he would just like find people and accuse them of witchcraft. And he would, swim the witch. The reason they were called lady prickers is because they would like, in England, you weren't allowed to torture people the same way that you could, like that inquisitorial torture. You weren't allowed to really do that in England. There were laws against it. But you could do like a little bit of torture. Like that was fine. You just couldn't like prick full your on ladies. Torture them. Mm-hmm.
That's what she said.
It's hilarious. But also not hilarious when you think of like where those witch teats were during that time period. Like it does bring on kind of like a different connotation that's kind of yucky. But yeah, no, they would like poke them. And if the witch didn't bleed, then they were a witch, and they would like run like a dull knife across their arm and put on this huge show and be like, look, she doesn't bleed, clearly she's a witch, when like you just didn't sharpen your knife, like it was a dummy butter knife that you're like rubbing against this person's skin, but they're not a witch because they didn't bleed, right? So the reason why the witch trial number is so high in England is like almost half of the trials come from Matthew Hopkins during the 1640s. He put like 300 plus people on trial and executed probably like 100 of them. And the funny thing is that like he would go into town and be like, I'm the witch finder general. I've been appointed by Parliament. He was a fucking liar. He wasn't appointed by Parliament. He would just go in and say it, and then they'd pay him a ton of money, and he would execute people and quote-unquote find witchcraft. And then there's a story that goes that, like, he was then accused of witchcraft, and he died when they threw him in the water, but unfortunately that's not what actually happened. He died of tuberculosis in 1647. But he wrote this book called The Discovery of Witches in 1647. And that same year, you have Alice Young over here in Connecticut, who becomes the first person executed for witchcraft. And according to some sources, that book, Discovery of Witches, was on the desk of some of the judges over here in the American colonies. In the Massachusetts Bay Colony with the Puritans, in 1641, they passed their like series of laws, and witchcraft was an executable offense, and it was only defined as consulting with a familiar spirit, and that was it.
Wow. So if you had a pet cat, They could be like, she's if you really liked your cat, if you pet your cat and cuddled it.
Right. If you, if there's like a reason why. So they would like, one of the things that they would do over here during the witch trials is they would like do like the waiting test, which was basically where they would just like put someone in a room and leave them for at least 24 hours without access to like food, water, toilet, anything that made them feel like a human being. And they would just wait with the idea that like, oh, your familiar will come, right? So like there are rats everywhere in New England. Are bugs everywhere in New England. So like if an animal would run into the room, they'd be like, ah, oh, there it is. There's the familiar, right? They also allowed spectral evidence, which spectral evidence is basically when someone says that they see something. It's like hearsay, right? So spectral evidence was allowed in some of the trials in England and was definitely allowed over here in the American colonies, which was basically like people would say that this whole idea was like when a witch was targeting you, they could make it so that no one else could see them, but you could see them. So like Jody, for example. Jody, you're just getting picked on, I guess.
She's a witch.
She's a witch. So we're going to just continue with that. True. So now we're in Connecticut or Massachusetts and you're still a witch. So what would happen is like Shay and I, if we could be in the same room and then all of a sudden I'm coming down and I'm like, oh God, yeah, Jody, she's scratching me and she's choking me. And I put on like a really, really good show about it. And I say, yeah, Jody attacked me. She choked me, she scratched me, she bit me. She did all of these things. And Shay could be standing right next to me. And Shay could be like, I didn't see anything. I saw her acting weird. And I could be like, no, Jody did it. I saw her do it. And because the Puritans were so extreme in their belief and followed the Bible so closely that they were not supposed to lie, people would just believe them.
They assumed the truth was coming out of their mouth.
So, what reason? You're a Puritan. What reason do you have to lie?
Right. This is interesting. This is going to tie into the 1980s, what you're saying right here. Just keep this little nugget in your brain here, because everything that you're talking about right here is directly applicable to the satanic panic of the 1980s.
I completely believe
just
it.
With less Puritans, but you know, still
still crazy.
And people bathe in the 1980s, so that's the big difference.
I mean, that's good. That's good.
We have progressed. Stinky.
And we have plumbing. We have indoor plumbing as well.
Yeah, our shit's just not sitting around.
We're not just doing it in chamber pots and dumping it out the window.
Right.
I cannot imagine.
When people are like, would you like to go back in time, if you could time travel, you go back in time or would you go into the future? And I'm like, anything before like 1800 smelled terrible. I mean, even the 1800s probably smelled terrible. So anything before indoor plumbing, I don't want to be there. No, thank you.
So you have like in the American colonies, the Puritans who were basically like, the Puritans came to Massachusetts because they were Protestant. They were of those people who like hated the Catholics, but they were like so extreme that like people in England couldn't stand them, and they like kicked them out of England and sent them over here to Massachusetts. And like, very long story short. And so they came here. Like, if you've seen the movie The Witch, it feels so accurate to how I think it would be. It is a really good movie. It's probably one of my favorite movies, but it feels so accurate of just like these extreme religious beliefs, and God permeates into every aspect of your life. If it's sunny, it's because of God. If it's raining, it's because of God. If your crops die, it's because of God punishing you in some way. If your crops are prosperous, it's God rewarding you in some way. I mean, you sneeze and it's probably God. Like, God permeated into every single freaking aspect of your life. Which means that, like, the devil permeates into every single aspect of your life, which is why witch trials happened over here. The most famous of which being the Salem witch trials. The Salem witch trials started in 1692, and the Salem witch trials, which again, if you've listened to my podcast or if you're a listener on my end, I did like a 3.5 hour episode on the Salem witch trials. So I'm not going to go into extreme detail because I've already been there and done that. But the Salem witch trials is incredibly detailed, incredibly convoluted, but it started in 1692 in the house of a reverend with these two little girls making accusations. They out of nowhere start exhibiting these crazy symptoms. They're barking like dogs. They're hiding under furniture. They're being pricked and prodded and poked, according to them, that people are sitting on their chests. They're seeing people in hoods. They're seeing people in their room. They're seeing all of these things. And it's children, age 9 and 11, who are being believed wholeheartedly for everything that they're doing. Because the devil is a reality, and children are so pure, they would have no reason to lie.
Children don't lie, right? Yes. Okay.
Absolutely. Yep. Children never tell lies. What are you talking about? From the mouth of babes, right? Like, there's no reason for them to lie. So you have these witch trials starting with that, and it's attacking children, which is very similar to like some of the satanic panics that you guys are going to talk about, I think, of the devil and the witches and the agents of the devil, Satan's servants, are targeting our children, and we will do anything to stop that. It starts with two little girls, Abigail Williams and Betty Paris, who are exhibiting these insane symptoms. And then wouldn't you know, soon after, other girls in town also start exhibiting these same symptoms. It comes to be a few girls between the ages of 9 and 17, and they become known as the afflicted girls in Salem. They are the ones who are the targets of the witchcraft. They are the ones who are being attacked the most. They are the ones who are seeing everything that there is to see. And they're at every single trial, putting on a show, being very convincing, using spectral evidence, saying, oh yeah, I saw her, she did this. They would have people on trial at the stand, and while the person is trying to defend themselves, they're screaming in the background, oh, she's biting me, she's choking me, or like they'd go mute and be like, oh goodness, like look what's happening to her, and then the judges would be like, why are you doing this to this girl? And the person on the stand would be like, I'm not. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not a devil. I'm not a witch. And because of the way that these trials went, they didn't believe them. Because of the foundations that you have from, you know, these first Hebrew myths of God or the devil being prideful and the devil being rebellious, they would go all the way back to that. And all these beliefs of how they've changed over time of who the devil is and how he works. You have in Salem where they're just saying, you are a witch. You are a servant of Salem. And the person accused of witchcraft would say, no, I'm not. And they would say, yes, you are. Why are you lying? Just tell the truth. When did you sell your soul to Satan? I never did. You are lying. Tell the truth. When did Satan first come to you? He's never come to me. You are lying. Tell the truth. When did you get your familiar? And it was just so certain that they were agents of the devil, and it was so certain that Satan was everywhere in society that it didn't matter if it made no sense. It didn't matter if people were speaking out. It didn't matter if people were arguing against it. The people in charge and the people making the accusations knew it to be true, even though it wasn't. And here in Salem, it led to arguably up to 200 people being accused of witchcraft. From the first accusation was made on February 29th, 1692. The trials officially, well, everyone was released from prison in May of 1693. The last trial was in January of 1693. So from February 29th until the end of January 1693, there were over 200 people who were accused. 20 people were killed. So 19 were hanged. One man was pressed to death. Like literally over 2 to 3 days was slowly pressed to death with rocks.
Oh God, that sounds terrible.
Oh, Giles Corey, he was an awful guy. Like he did some terrible things in his life. He once beat a servant to death for stealing apples. He went on trial against his wife during the witch trials and was largely the reason that she was convicted. He was an angry, cantankerous, terrible man, but he refused to cooperate with the people in charge. They asked him to put in a plea and he refused. And when they couldn't get him and couldn't convince him to put in a plea, they did something called the pain for the door, which is cruel and harsh punishment. And it's a torture technique where you lay someone on the ground and you put a board on top of their chest and start piling rocks onto them until they confess. It's quite literally putting the pressure on them to get them to say the things that you want to say.
Oh, that's
disgusting. And Giles Corey never said anything and was slowly pressed to death over 2 to 3 days and finally was crushed to death, having never said anything, and was buried in an unmarked grave, was excommunicated from the church. And
aren't people suffered swell?
They're just great. People are They're just wonderful. Like,
whenever I read this stuff, I always am impressed by the creativity of
their
torture.
And we're a very creative animal, aren't we?
Back then especially. Man, they had no bounds to torture.
No, and we're very creative in the way that we've killed people throughout time. But in Salem, people were so convinced of it that they were just murdering people. I mean, they were victims. These people were murdered by an unjust system, and it was completely cruel and it was completely horrible. And again, I have a whole episode where I go into all the details of it, but this was like a big satanic panic here in Salem. I mean, it really was. It was a witch panic, but it was a satanic panic.
Well, centuries later, it's very well known that
Salem is defined by it. I mean, I live in Salem and people come every year. I mean, some people come actually caring about the history. Most people come as like a fun tourist destination, which is always weird to me that like you're going to come for a fun tourist destination where like 20 people were killed horribly. 5 people died in prison while waiting their trial, including an infant.
Ugh.
And isn't that fun?
That infant witch.
The infant. Yeah. Well, so the infant, one of the first people who was accused was a woman named Sarah Good. And she was poor and pregnant and people didn't like her because she was outspoken. And she was one of the first people accused. So the first people who were accused was Tituba, who was an indigenous person who was enslaved by the Reverend household. And it was Sarah Good, who was a poor beggar who was pregnant. And then it was Sarah Osborne, who was an older woman who had been like caught up in some scandal beforehand. Again, I go into a ton of details. So I won't go into extreme detail here, but Sarah Good was convicted of witchcraft, but because she was pregnant, they refused to execute her until after she gave birth to her child because like, oh, this is an innocent soul, like whatever. But when she gave birth to her child, they didn't remove the baby from prison. And so after she gave birth, they left the baby in there with her because the baby needed to be with its mother, basically was the thought process behind it. And the baby lived a very short life and died. And then Sarah Good was taken away to be executed and left behind her 4-year-old daughter, who was a girl named Dorothy Good. And Dorothy Good spent 9 months in prison.
4-year-old?
No one bailed her out. She was 4 years old. Nobody bailed her out. Nobody helped her. Nobody did anything for her because she was a child of a witch and she was accused of witchcraft. Even though she wasn't convicted of witchcraft, she was found innocent. The way that things ran here was you were not allowed to be released from prison until your debt was paid. And nobody paid the debt to let her out. And for the rest of her life, she's referred to as Mad Dorothy Good because she went insane from the trauma that happened in that prison when she was 4 years old after 9 months of being imprisoned.
For the rest of her life, how long was that?
She lived until like her 40s or 50s.
Oh, wow. So she was eventually let out? Or she lived her
Yeah, she was.
Okay.
The queen over in England heard about it after the fact. And in May of 1693, was like, this is ridiculous. You need to let everybody out. And so they were kind of forced to release people from prison. And so at some point, someone paid her debt to let her out. We don't know who, but at some point, someone let her out. And then for the rest of her life, we have petitions from her father asking for help for his daughter, Mad Dorothy Good.
That's terrible.
And I think the one kind of little thing that I'll kind of end on, because again, I, you know, elaborate on all of this for the witch trials. Sarah Good, after everything that happened to her, she is taken to the execution site. And overseeing the execution was always a reverend. This man was Nicholas Noyes was the reverend who was overseeing it. And his job as the reverend was not to like offer comfort or offer prayers. His 19 of the 20 people who were executed died either never have confessing to witchcraft. So you have the one person who never said anything. And then the other 18 people died saying that they were innocent. You have one person who confessed who was executed. So she had said that she was innocent. She had said that, you know, she was not actually a witch. And so Reverend Nicholas Noyes was there to receive your final confession, which needed to be, in their opinion, ah, you got me. I've actually been a witch this whole time. I thought that I fooled you, but obviously I didn't, right? And when he was standing before Sarah Good, he said, you know, do you have any final words? Just confess that you are a witch. And she said, I am no more a witch than you are a wizard, sir. And if you take away my life, God will give you blood to drink.
Oof.
And then she's executed for it. She's executed for witchcraft. But 24 years later in 1716, Reverend Nicholas Noyes was found dead with blood in his mouth.
Oh, I like that.
I know.
Right? Oh, that's spooky.
It's one of my favorite stories about the witch trials.
Wow.
It becomes known as the Curse of Sarah Good, but there's also like this argument back and forth, right? Because like on the one hand, it's people who believe that she was a witch saying, oh, that was Satan. Like, you just waited 24 years. What's 24 years to Satan, right? But on the other end, what she said, God will give you blood to drink, is a quote from the book of Revelations in which they talk about false prophets and false priests and God giving them blood to drink for all of the wrong that they did. Mm. So the people who believe that she wasn't a witch believed that it was God giving him blood to drink because he was a false prophet and was telling lies and all of that. So the satanic panics of the witch trials kind of pitters off after the Salem witch trials. In England, the last person was executed in the 1680s. They had kind of ended their witch trials over there. They were kind of like pittering off on anything that they were doing because it was kind of extreme during Matthew Hopkins' period with the 300 people who were accused. It was kind of a little extreme for them. So they were kind of pittering off over in England. And then you have Salem that happened. And when people in England heard about Salem, they're kind of like, all right, we're not doing this anymore. Like, yeah, witchcraft exists, Satan exists, but like, this has become too much. And there were a couple of trials, but no one was executed for it. And then in 1735, you have the final witchcraft act that's passed, where the queen in England was like, we're not doing this anymore. If you accuse someone of being a witch, that's fine. We're not doing anything with this anymore. It's no longer an executable offense, which kind of ends the satanic panics in England and the British American colonies. You still have a couple trials that happen in the other parts of Europe, but I'm not really well versed in those, so I'm not going to talk about them. But that's kind of like where my expertise comes to an end, where I think now we'll like pass it over to you guys and you guys have to say about it.
So once it was illegal to torture and kill these witches, witchcraft just became not a problem anymore.
Yeah. I mean, there were still people who were accused of witchcraft.
But it was just
there were still people who would be like, she's a witch, but like you couldn't take someone to court for it anymore.
Crazy.
So there were still some people who like on a neighborly, you know, thing, probably lynchings happened.
Okay, sure. Mm-hmm.
There were occasions that happened on the common person level, but it's not something that you can raise to court anymore. You can't take someone to court and say like, they're a witch and be convicted for it. In some areas of England, witchcraft was the second most popular crime, second only theft for a while. And so to have that being like such a prevalent part of society, and then you have the satanic panic in Salem kind of pittering it over and people being like, okay, you know, we've gone too far. 200 people in 10 months is just too much. Like, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do this anymore. And it kind of leading to people just being like, yeah, we're done with this. It's kind of, you're heading into the age of science now where people are arguing, does witchcraft even exist? Does God even exist? Does the devil even exist? Witch trials are kind of archaic at that point, right? Mm-hmm. So why would we still why would we still do it, you know?
Well, this was totally fascinating. I knew about the Salem witch trials, but you have some great detail. You're quite a historian.
You're meteoric, not mediocre.
There we go. Yes.
Oh, that's very kind. As I talk your ear off for 2 hours.
Because you're so knowledgeable, though, because you have so much. And I know you probably cut yourself short. You have so much knowledge. So it was great.
That's okay. I have other episodes that people can listen to about some of this stuff,
so. You can go on and on.
you can go listen to some of those other ones.
That's exactly why we're doing this. So our listeners will come on over to your site and vice versa. So absolutely. I'm glad to expose our listeners to this wonderful topic.
Yeah, totally.
Well, and you've set the scene kind of perfectly for me to pick up over on our feed, because a lot of the things that you have been talking about from the 1962 beginning of the witch panic.
1962?
Excuse me.
1692. You're good.
Thank you. I'm not good with numbers, especially if they're Roman numerals.
Yeah, she doesn't know what those are.
Geography, time zones, Roman numerals, math. I'm bad at all those.
I'm awful at geography, so I feel that one.
So you really set the scene for us to pick up. So everybody needs to move over to our feed, and you can pick up that.
Where the satanic panic comes into this century,
what we determine the satanic panic is
right
now.
Actually, it's last century at this point, right?
Exactly.
But it is continuing into now. So yes.
Editing, Christina here. As a little enticement to get you all to head on over to the Rainy Day Rabbit Holes podcast to listen to part two of this, I wanted to just insert some of my favorite clips from my guest spot that I did on their podcast. So I'm going to throw those in right here. And then make sure that you go and head over to the Rainy Day Rabbit Hole podcast and listen to what I did with Jody and Shay, because it was a good time all around. And I had a fantastic time having them over on my podcast as well. I hope that you guys liked it all. All right, I'm going to stop talking. Here's the clips.
Fast forward to 1930, when Anton LaVey was born on April 11th, the date that this came out. What a coincidence.
I know nothing about this, so you could tell me that he said that the sky was purple, and I would be like, oh, well, there was a time that the sky was purple. That makes total sense.
He probably did say the sky was purple. He loved to lie. Okay, so this is the Church of Satan, which for the next several decades, people will refer to as having bred all these Satanists that are doing these horrible satanic rituals, and especially to children.
Right,
but one of
focus,
the tenets
right?
of the Church of Satan is do not harm little children.
I wish you could see me literally flapping my arms over here as I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, you mean when people were questioned repeatedly during the witch trials and by modern day detectives just to get them to confess, to get it to stop? Just over and over and over and over and over again telling you what happened and trying to coax stuff out of you to make you falsely remember things that you did. I'm sorry, I'm going to mute myself again.
A satanic doctor sewing horns and a tail onto Michelle. Keep your pants on. We'll get to why. There's a good reason why there's no evidence. And so she finally said that she was miraculously saved from marrying Satan by the Virgin Mary herself. Are you sure it wasn't Satan?
Maybe I should have just gone to a certain therapist
right.
to draw these memories out of me.
Okay, so fortunately,
you just believed in the devil with your hips.
With your hips.
So, everyone, go over to the Rainy Day Rabbit Holes podcast to hear part two. But that is where we're going to end today over on mine. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you heard and want to hear more, please consider subscribing or leaving a review or joining my Patreon. And do you guys have a Patreon or anything that you're doing on your side that people can join if they want to after they listen to your podcast?
So, yeah, we have a brand new Patreon with lots of bonus content and merch and all sorts of good stuff. So if you head to our website, rainydayrabbitholes.com, that's where you can find all the information about Patreon. You can find links to our social. You can find all the links to listen. You can find blog posts with extra links. And you can also find our sources when we actually get around to putting them up. But that's one-stop shop is rainydayrabbitholes.com for everything Rainy Day Rabbit Holes podcast.
Perfect. So go head over there and support them. And remember, friends, history may be watching you, so don't fuck it up. Bye.